the headlines this hour. Iran's army and IRGC kick off large-scale military drills using the country's indigenous air defense missile systems. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country can only defend its skies if its Western allies provide Kyiv with fighter jets. And North Korea's leader orders government officials to engineer what he calls fundamental transformation in agricultural production amid fears of food shortages. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran has kicked off massive aerial drills with the aim of assessing response to possible attacks on the country's key defense and nuclear installations. The spokesman says air defense units of the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps are taking part in the joint exercises. Brigadier General Amir Abbas Alamdari says the air divisions on the first day of their maneuvers focused on detecting hostile objects and electronic simulation to intercept them. The general says they would also practice establishing safe connection of multi-layered communications with the integrated air command and control network to make timely decision in the event of threats. The Army and the IRGC are using indigenously made systems and weapons in the drills that cover more than 1 million square kilometers of Iranian airspace. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has met with the UN Secretary General on the sidelines of the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. In an interview with Press TV, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman talked about the issues Amir Abdollahian discussed during his meeting with Antonio Guterres.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and UN Chief Antonio Guterres discussed the crisis in Yemen. In this regard, Guterres called on the Islamic Republic to continue to play its constructive role in resolving the conflict in the Arab country. The UN Chief and Iran's Foreign Minister also talked about the Ukraine war. Amir Abdollahian reiterated Tehran's stance on the war, saying his country is ready to use its capacities to help put an end to the Ukraine conflict. Also on Iran's nuclear program, they talked about the upcoming trip by the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Iran. Guterres and Amir Abdollahian expressed hope that Rafael Grossi's visit can patch up the remaining differences between Tehran and the UN nuclear watchdog. Meanwhile, regarding talks to revive the 2015 deal, the Iranian foreign minister notified the UN chief of the latest messages exchanged through diplomatic means.
Russia says it will not rejoin a key nuclear arms reduction treaty until the West changes its attitude toward Moscow. The Kremlin spokesman said that NATO has now turned into Russia's enemy by arming Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov added that the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of the security of another. Last week, President Vladimir Putin announced Russia's decision to suspend participation in the New START treaty. He cited Washington's failure to keep its end of the bargain and its deepening involvement in the Ukraine war. The U.S. called the move deeply unfortunate and irresponsible. The New START treaty was signed between the U.S. and Russia in 2010. It puts a limit on nuclear devices and the means of their delivery. Russia has accused the U.S. and other Western countries of disrupting its relations with Africa. Russia says the move by, quote, the collective West is aimed at isolating Moscow following what it calls its special military operation in Ukraine.
The U.S. desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of the special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally.
The U.S. approach toward Russia comes at a time when millions of Africans appear to be fed up with Western presence on their soil. That can be highlighted in recent anti-West sentiment in such countries like Burkina Faso, where protesters demanded the immediate withdrawal of French forces. With anger growing in Africa against the West, it seems that the era of Western colonialism is taking its last breaths.
The visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge the global arrogance. In the words of Pandor herself, the current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pandor argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seemed to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West's imperialism.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterates his plea to his Western allies to provide his country with fighter jets to defend its skies.
Our pilots and anti-aircraft units and other experts of our Air Force are doing a great job, but we will be able to completely protect our skies when the aviation taboo is fully lifted in relations with our partners.
Zelensky's request to shore up his country's air forces comes as the West remains undecided to provide Kyiv with warplanes. Ukraine has been given billions of dollars in military aid by its Western backers. The U.S. and some European countries also announced to equip Kyiv with their main battle tanks. Washington has said that it will send an additional $1.2 billion in financial aid to Kyiv. The announcement was made by the U.S. Treasury Secretary during her visit to Ukraine. Janet Yellen said the U.S. would also press for more action from its allies to support Ukraine in its war with Russia. Washington has been the biggest supplier of arms to Kyiv since the war broke out. The Russian military has intensified its attacks on the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region to take control of it. According to Ukraine's military, the Russian army has surrounded the city in a bid to force Ukrainian troops to surrender. Ukrainian commanders say the situation there is extremely tense due to constant Russian shelling and the attempt to cut the supply lines. Meanwhile, the Russian army said it had targeted an ammunition depot and shut down U.S.-made rockets and Ukrainian drones. The capture of Bakhmut would pave the way for Russian forces to take control of the last remaining urban areas in the region. Ukraine says there is no sign that China is mulling the transfer of weapons to Russia despite U.S. claims. Head of Ukraine's military intelligence, Kirilo Budinov, also expressed doubt that the Chinese officials have even talked about the issue. U.S. officials recently accused China of considering providing Russia with lethal military equipment. Beijing denied the claim, saying it is the U.S. that is sending arms to the conflict zone, not China. It also slammed Washington for imposing sanctions against its companies over allegedly providing intelligence to the Russian army.
The actions of the United States have no basis in international law at all, nor are they authorized by the UN Security Council. They are typical illegal unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction which seriously damage China's interest. China is strongly dissatisfied and firmly opposed to this and has lodged stern representation with the U.S.
Mao also vowed resolute countermeasures by China. The spokesperson added that the U.S. must stop spreading disinformation and withdraw sanctions on Chinese companies. China has repeatedly called for peaceful resolution of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. It has also recently unveiled a 12-point position paper on the political settlement of the crisis. Geopolitical analyst Jeff Brown earlier joined us with his take on China's initiative to settle the Ukraine crisis, as well as his thoughts on Western military support for Kyiv.
There are things that Russia would not agree with in the 12-point plan. There are things that Ukraine would not agree with in the 12-point plan. President Orbán of Hungary supported it, and it has gotten a good reception outside of the what I call Euranglo land, the West and Israel. So it has been a success from a diplomatic and media standpoint for China. I would say that the NATO, the generals, and the American Joint Chiefs of Staff are absolutely delusional. Either that, or they're putting up a good face for the public by saying we're winning and Russia's losing. This is an existential battle between the West, basically, and the East: Iran, Russia, DPRK. China and the global majority versus the NATO, global minority, what I call Euranglo land, Israel and the West.
The United States has joined Canada and the European Union in imposing a ban on Chinese video sharing social networking service TikTok. The White House says federal agencies have been asked to remove and disallow installations of the application on devices operated by their staff. The deadline is set to comply with an order issued by Congress. The ban excludes businesses not associated with the federal government or to millions of private citizens. Canada and the EU have also banned TikTok from their devices. TikTok, which has 1 billion users globally, has rejected accusations of sharing data with the Chinese government. China has also accused the U.S. of overstretching the concept of national security and abusing state power to suppress foreign companies. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has called for a fundamental transformation in agricultural production as the country is reportedly grappling with food shortages. Kim emphasized the importance of stabilizing agricultural sector, saying hitting grain production targets this year is a top priority. He did not elaborate on measures the country would take, but said the changes need to happen over the next few years. Kim was speaking during the second day of a key party meeting on Monday. His remarks came weeks after South Korea's unification ministry claimed that there had been reports of starvation deaths in the north. Pyongyang is under strict international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. This has been compounded by a self-imposed border closure by North Korea since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith earlier explained the connection between international sanctions and food shortages in North Korea.
We need to look at where those sanctions are applied, how those sanctions are applied, what they affect. And sometimes it's difficult to make a connection between the item that's sanctioned or the category of items that are sanctioned and food shortages. The main example that I want to use here is oil. So it's suggested that by denying North Korea access to oil, you're going to affect its ability to pursue its missile and nuclear technologies and force the regime into negotiations on that issue. That's the reason behind these U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions. But oil is an integral element for North Korean food production, so it has a direct impact on how much food can be produced by North Korea and feed its people. We had some other information about the food shortage in North Korea that suggested they had cut rationing from just over 600 grams to 620 grams per person to under 600 grams per person. This is for the military, 580 grams per person. So this is having a quantitative effect on the, you know, sustenance that's being provided to the North Korean people.
Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magner talks about how Syria and the Syrian people have been neglected, especially in the wake of the devastating earthquake.
What they're trying to say to Syria, we're coming to see you, but we still don't have the full support to restart the reconstruction. Syria needs between $500 and $800 billion to be reconstructed. The Arab didn't invest anything. It's only a bit a shy Russian support on the military side, but a lot of Iranian support. Every 15 days, there is a tanker of oil. There is a humanitarian support that's coming through the border on a very regular basis. Where are the Arabs and the Gulf-rich countries? They don't dare to support Syria because Syria is still under the sanctions, still under Caesar sanctions, and the Americans are shying away their interest in Syria, although they are present in stealing the Syrian oil and the Syrian food basket. If they really want to support Syria, they just can leave and end their occupation and allow the Syrians to benefit from their own natural resources. So the return of the Arab is really a visit of a foreign minister is not really a big event if it is not followed by a serious plan of reconstructing Syria.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the geopolitical situation in West Asia with strategic analyst Sharmeen Narwani. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
The world is experiencing fundamental changes in the global power constellation, and as the geostrategically most important region in the world, West Asia is in the middle of these historic transformations. Like other regions in the world, it's experiencing major economic problems related to inflation and the combined aftereffects of the global COVID pandemic, US mismanagement of the global economy, and more than 20 years of a devastating global war by the US in the name of the so-called War on Terror. The world is only now coming to understand the profound significance of the historic defeat that the US and its allies experienced in West Asia in the early 21st century, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan, which some have suggested was a third world war by historic standards, and which effectively ended any claims of the US to global hegemony and began a reordering of global affairs by the victors. But who were the winners of this Third World War? the Islamic Republic of Iran, with its allies in the various resistance movements of the region, joined later by a resurgent Russia and a rising China, who are all now in the process of creating a new global order with its own institutions, independent of the West for the first time in centuries. This is turning out to be a big test for many local elites in West Asia, who have staked their continued worldly power and existence on US and Western backing. And we are already witnessing their desperate efforts to quickly reorient themselves towards these new powers in order to save their illegitimate tribal and military dictatorships. What's clear to most observers is that West Asia will be very different at the end of the year 2023 than it is at the beginning of the year 2023.
Sharmeen Narwani, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You are the editor-in-chief and columnist of the Cradle online magazine, which deals with, which focuses on the geopolitics of West Asia, and you recently launched the Arabic language edition. I'm very happy that we're able to do this conversation. I follow your publication, and there are a lot of excellent analysis and articles and news items in there. Always, a good place for people to go to if they want to know what's going on in West Asia. And so we're going to take this opportunity in this conversation to look at a more broad analysis of, make a more broad analysis of what's happening in West Asia. There's a lot of interesting things happening. Your publication also talks about the new year, 2023. You have some of your columnists and your contributors making predictions, making some analysis. So we can start wherever you want. I can suggest, if you like, with your permission, we start with the very interesting article that you had in your publication related to the way in which the Americans are basically blackmailing Iraq, because in terms of the money that they the oil money, the oil sales money that the Iraqis have to send to the U.S., and that the U.S. is basically, blackmailing the Iraqis. If you could give us a little insight into that story, and we can start there and go to other places later.
Well, there are quite a few countries in the region now that are experiencing severe economic downturns. And right. Some of these are natural because governments have not planned ahead. Governments borrow money excessively, whether for the IMF or allies in the region and abroad, and they don't really have programs. There's a lot of corruption. So, but what's happening recently, I think in the last few years, is an escalation of the sanctions tool, the U.S. sanctions tool,
right,
to bring even allies into line, mm-hmm, with U.S. Policy ambitions in the region. And the most recent, Turkey's experienced this, for instance, a NATO
Correct.
Ally.
Correct.
But most recently, we're seeing this in Iraq. And what happened recently is that about 19 Iraqi banks were sanctioned. That decreased the central bank sales of dollars by about 40%,
mm-hmm,
which led to a huge decline in supply.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge decline in the ability for banks to transfer dollars. You would have to wait a minimum of 15 days now to transfer dollars anywhere. Part of this was to get a handle on the dollars that were moving in the Iraqi market, particularly outside of Iraq, to countries like Iran, mm-hmm, Syria, and Lebanon. So.
Right.
These particular screws that were put on Iraq specify Lebanon as one of those target countries,
right,
where dollars are being contained. But I think, this article that we wrote it went viral. I think even Iraqi journalists, we don't see a lot of light shining on.
That's right.
Issues that are of huge importance to the economic independence and political independence of the country. Seems like Iraqi politicians themselves, no matter what side, do not want to discuss the nitty-gritty. And an example of this is that our article shines a light on the fact that since 2003, the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, all Iraqi oil revenues must be sent to a single bank account in the United States. Okay, not multiple, not dollar accounts in Singapore or in Europe or anywhere. One single bank account in the United States. This is by the occupying and invading entity.
Right.
And all these years later, exactly 20 years later, this practice continues. And this is a key point of leverage that the Americans continue to exercise over all Iraqi political decisions. If you don't do this, we will not release your oil revenue dollar supply in our bank, right?
Right.
But this is something like you're hard pressed to find Iraqi politicians, again, on both sides of the political aisle or all sides of the political spectrum, to address this very critical issue. How can Iraq use its dollars, use its oil revenues to invest in infrastructure, you know, key infrastructure that is severely affecting the population? Like access to water, electricity, et cetera. You know, we've seen protests about these kind of things. How can they do that when they don't control their revenues? So I think this is a very important thing, and we hope in the next, at the cradle, in the next few weeks and months to delve deeper into the subject and try to get Iraqi politicians on the record about, and this issue on the table in Iraq. You know, why is our money there, and how do we diversify it so that we have control over our revenues?
That's very interesting you mentioned that, because, you know, everybody probably remembers that during the sanctions before the American invasion, there was the famous oil for food program, which, you know, didn't really do much for the Iraqis even at that time. But it seems that this is just a continuation of that. And then, of course, we have that famous photograph of Senator, now Senator Tom Cotton, who was an American officer in the Iraq War, sitting on this pile of gold bars from the Iraqi Central Bank, which apparently this was reported at that time. I haven't seen any reporting after that, but at that time it was reported that basically all the gold reserves were shipped off to Canada after the invasion. So it seems that, you know, this whole occupation that the Americans had was very much that old school mercantilist, you know, colonialist, imperialist strategy: get the oil, get the gold, and not really caring about other things. And so it seems that maybe Iraq, until this is solved, until this is resolved in some way, is not going to be able to be a normal country and deal with other countries, as we've seen, for example, with some of the cases that it had with Iran. Is there anything else you might want to add to that?
Do you know, I think what's happening is very critical here, because, I mean, this has been going on for absolute decades. It's not a recent thing, but there has always been Western efforts to shutter the borders between Iran and Iraq, between Iraq and Syria, between Syria and Lebanon. And that continues. I mean, you actually have U.S. troops stationed at the Syrian-Iraqi border to inhibit the flow of goods and, transportation vehicles and whatever for the last number of years.
We just had that recent attack on the Iranian convoy that was sending, you know, diapers and the gloves, the sanitary gloves.
Yes. And, you know, we have a new Iraqi prime minister, Prime Minister Sudani, and he comes in as a nominee of the more pro-Iran elements of the Iraqi body politic. And so he's an unknown factor. The previous prime minister, Mustafa al-Kazemi, was pretty much, you know, towed the American line on all things. Prior to him, you had Adel Abdel Mahdi.
Right.
And he was very interesting because he was doing some unusual things in Iraq. Just before the October protests broke out in 2019, and basically, scuttled all political movement, development, economic, political, movements, et cetera. And one of the things he did was open officially the Iraqi-Syrian border.
That's That's right.
The other thing he did was he signed an agreement with the Chinese, basically an oil for infrastructure deal, and a couple of other things like that within a short space of time, which absolutely, sort of, raised all kinds of alarms for the Americans.
Right.
And then within no time, you had the October protests. And this is how they do. They can create domestic strife in countries. They can sanction entities. They can use financial tools to destabilize the national currency.
Right.
They can set off a fire or a bomb here and there. But to me, it seems that these are the only tools left in the U.S. policy toolbox. They
right.
are not going to engage in a war or fan the flames towards a war because they cannot afford this. Their sights are firmly set on the Russian theater,
right.
With the Chinese one not far behind. I mean, many American policymakers argue that China's number one. Why are we wasting our time on Russia? And then there are those who take a flip view. But for right now, West Asia can pretty much assure itself that there's not going to be any major hot war in the region, but we are going to have plenty of troubling instigations, sabotage,
right.
Efforts to buy off people and to sway perceptions, that kind of thing, but the toolbox is very small these days for the Americans. But I think Iraq is a perfect example of a recently targeted state, and it comes as a warning to Sudani, who, as I said, was, it was a nominee from the sort of a pro-Iran coalition in Iraq, to not rock the boat too much. And, sure enough, Sudani made a statement about a week or two ago saying he's not troubled by U.S. troops stationed in the country, et cetera, which I didn't take very seriously because his role ultimately is to balance Iran and the U.S., which is unfortunate because an Iraqi prime minister's role should not be to balance these two countries.
Right. Exactly.
It should be to pave a pathway for Iraq's economic development, and
Iraq's national interests. That should be the focus.
I mean, in Iraq, in Lebanon, they're treading water.
Right.
And I mean, there's a point to that. I don't particularly think much of the slow bloodletting that happens. These sanctions on Syria are absolutely oppressive, on Iran, now on Iraq, on Turkey, Egypt's economy. Why are we all treading water instead of carving a new path together?
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because it seems to me that what you're talking about is really a problem of the elites of those countries. They're not having the power to be able to define their own national interests. Of course, Iran, the big exception in this case, having a revolution, having an independent system of governance, no matter what one might want to criticize, and there are things to criticize about Iran, but it is an independent country. It makes its own decisions based on its national interests. So you mentioned Egypt. There's a lot to talk about Iraq. We could go on for the whole program. So let's move to Egypt. You were talking about how a lot of the economies in the region are experiencing problems. And, of course, Egypt is maybe, experiencing the worst economic crisis, in a very long time. There was this very secret, under the radar, your publication reported about it, this very secretive, under the radar summit of leaders of some Arab countries in the Emirates, of course, without the presence of the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. And it seems the King of Jordan was there, the Egyptian leadership was there, and it seems that the main focus was trying to basically, save Egypt from this social economic catastrophe that's looming there. If you could please, share some insight into this issue with us.
Well, the columnist Abdel Bari Atwan, who wrote that
very
piece,
famous columnist.
He's wonderful. He didn't know the answers to why there was an emergency summit called for the next day that required the attendance of heads of states. Not only heads of states of Egypt and Jordan, but of four of the GCC countries. So he had to analyze what potentially was the subject under discussion, and came up with two things. One was, King Abdullah flew over,
right,
and suddenly you had this meeting. So what that could suggest, for instance, is because in Egypt the previous day, the meeting was included the Palestinian head of state. King Abdullah had been...
Right, King Abdullah of Jordan.
King Abdullah of Jordan had been attending,
right,
a meeting that included Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
Correct.
And we know recently there has been a lot of concern about the status of Jerusalem and the new right-wing Israeli government's,
that's right,
efforts to depopulate Jerusalem of Palestinian residents and to also, attack Al-Aqsa Mosque and potentially destroy it. So, and King Abdullah of Jordan has voiced significant concern because he is viewed as the custodian of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem,
right,
and fears that that status is about to be taken out from under him. So that was one potential topic of discussion, and the other one was Egypt's economy. I mean, we're talking about the entire collapse of the state, the inability for Egypt to address the most basic services,
right,
of its country, and the IMF has said that Egypt needs $40 billion in immediate aid, otherwise the state's collapse is imminent and inevitable. So,
right,
traditionally, Egypt, I think since the beginning of the Arab Spring, has taken in financial assistance from Persian Gulf countries to of a much larger amount than $40 billion. But Persian Gulf countries recently, and perhaps this is why the Saudis and Kuwaitis didn't attend, the Kuwaiti parliament took a decision not to give Egypt any more aid. And the Saudis have now announced, I think we heard at Davos recently, that there will be no unconditional aid anymore,
mm-hmm,
to anyone, okay?
Right.
So I think these were two potential topics under discussion at the secretive meeting in Abu Dhabi. But I don't know if this was such an important meeting after all. There are these kind of meetings that are taking place all the time.
Right.
There's a lot of troubleshooting going on in this region. There are a lot of plans afoot, and there are a lot of shifting alliances,
Right.
And this is what's important, not just between regional states, but between great powers and the region. So we,
right,
see in the Persian Gulf, for instance, now the Saudis and Emiratis, who are the key players in the GCC, the key decision makers and drivers,
right,
of GCC policy, stepping up their relations with China and Russia,
right,
and brushing off American attempts to force them into oil pricing and oil production that doesn't benefit these countries. So we're seeing more independent foreign policies emerge under the younger leadership of in the GCC. And so it's there's no enmity. They're not taking sides between the US and Russia and China now.
Right.
They are exploiting all opportunities. They're being opportunistic, which is how politics should be. In
right.
a way, you do what benefits you. But then regionally, of course, you have crazy shuttle diplomacy being, taking place for the last few years. The Turks, after being fully isolated in the region, and this comes a mere 10 years after being absolutely lauded by Arab leaders in the region,
mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
its policies and its good neighborliness, having realized how isolated they were, have ventured to try to reopen relations with Egypt and with the UAE and others in the region and the Saudis. The Saudi and Iranian rapprochement, for instance, and
right.
the Emiratis and the Iranians and the Qataris and the Iranians and it goes on, and the Qataris within the GCC, and of course Turkey with Syria. So we're seeing a lot of troubleshooting going on in shuttle diplomacy. The question is, will it arrive at anything? And when it does, what are the alliances going to look like in the region?
Right.
What are the the things that will drive these alliances. It usually is for something, you know, economy, for instance,
right.
Or geopolitical play, you know. And these can shift very easily because, you know, if you look at any of these countries, you will have a domestic reasons for making decisions.
Right.
You will have regional ones, and then you have international ones. So I see in this year a lot of shifts depending on things that rise in the region. But I think everyone's keeping doors open now because they have learned that closing doors is not leading anyone in this region to a better place.
Right. So it seems to me that the overarching title of this could be just the fact that, you know, American hegemony is kind of, you know, on the decline, that those that there's a feeling among those who were maybe the closest allies of the U.S. that the U.S. can no longer support their family rule the way it used to in this unconditional way. We saw, for example, the way that the Yemenis were able to really pound the Saudis in a way that nobody expected. And there were at times when you literally had the Yemenis striking back into Saudi, deep into Saudi territory. And of course, the Americans not doing anything about it. So let's talk a little bit about this changing, this what the Saudis really are after. It seems to me it's always about the Ali Saud. It's always about keeping the Saudi family in power. You know, we have these, you know, things that they do. They allow Halloween and they allow pop concerts so that the young people don't, you know, dare. God forbid the young people should ask for, you know, a elected government there, or somehow the Ali Saud not being able to, you know, no longer ruling there, having actually an elected government of some form there. So let's talk about this idea that the Saudis are attempting to, the Ali Saud are attempting to kind of, you know, continue their dictatorial rule, but maybe this time with the support of the Chinese or with some other country. And how feasible is that really? Because if we see their whole rule was based on the Americans really, you know, bringing them to power and keeping them in power.
Well, you know, many states come into being for a reason, but then after generations, take a life of their own, you know, create their own reasons to be, reasons to exist. You know, I always think of Jordan during the reign of King Hussein. You know, Jordan is not resource rich. Its main resource is its human resource, which it generously lends out to Gulf countries and other countries in the region. So he had to make this state, Jordan, which had no relevance and no real borders, you know, before established by imperial powers and colonial powers. Relevant. And so King Hussein made Jordan relevant by being a mediator to all. And King Abdullah, his son, has shut the door on that by basically having relations with only one side. What is Jordan's relevance today except being a buffer state? I would argue that obviously the Saudis and the Emiratis and Gulf countries, because of their natural resources, have more longevity and reason to be for longer. What's interesting now is, as I mentioned earlier in the program, the younger generation coming in for the first time in a very long time. And this younger generation, what intrigues me sociologically about them is they did not grow up with absolute reverence and deference to the imperial power that established them. They went to schools, they went to Sandhurst, they went to Georgetown, you know, they went to Western schools. They come, you know, while extremely privileged, lived unusually privileged life in those capitals, Western capitals. And, you know, with it comes a certain arrogance. So they're not going to be like their fathers and grandfathers, ultimately knowing who pulls the strings. They have agendas of their own. And I think that, I mean, we're seeing this, for instance, in the Palestinian youth today. A generation has passed since the, you know, the Oslo agreement and the Madrid peace talks. And the parents of the younger generation emerging in the West Bank today were absolutely, you know, deferential to the Oslo system, waiting for the rewards of that and following and, you know, the the system as it was designed to oppress Palestinians, but having Palestinians do instead of Israelis.
Right.
We have another generation now that is turning conventional relationships on its head and maybe thinking differently about the future of their countries. So I don't see the Saudis disappearing overnight. I don't even think their sort of foes in the region, you know, Iran, want to see that. I mean, nobody wants a Wahhabi country with I don't know how many Patriot missiles and, you know, state-of-the-art military equipment to disrupted from within. These are very dangerous scenarios, and almost any country you look like that have experienced these color revolutions and other kinds of internal disruptions, you have the falling apart of the state. You know, you have the spreading of small weapons, medium weapons, that kind of thing. Nobody wants a destabilized Saudi Arabia. You know, but I think that country is going to evolve like other countries have to in the region. They fully understand that they cannot depend, as you said, on the Americans to help them out militarily, as was the case in Yemen when almost every Saudi city has been targeted by Ansarallah missiles right now and several UAE cities as well. And there was no Americans to the rescue. In fact, these countries watched the Iranians lob a dozen ballistic missiles into several U.S. bases in Iraq without a reciprocal American reaction. They saw Iran shoot down an American state-of-the-art $200 million-plus stealth drone without an American reaction. So they understand that the U.S. is not going to come to anyone's assistance, which is why this younger generation is now diversifying its relations with rising powers like Russia and major economic powerhouses like China,
right,
who is demanding in turn that these countries participate in its ambitious multi-trillion-dollar Belt and Road Initiative, which fundamentally will upend Western shipping and transportation systems and mechanisms throughout the world. The Chinese are going to create land routes throughout all of Asia and into Europe that did not exist, train routes and waterway routes, as are the Russians. The Iranians, the Pakistanis, a lot of Asian countries now are, have now for a few years been actively pursuing these alternative routes, which, by the way, make shipping a lot cheaper, but
right,
importantly brings this valuable, important ability into their hands, into their national hands. You're not dependent on the Suez Canal if Iraq, by the way, has launched a project, okay,
mm-hmm.
A route that would cut the Suez route, and we have a map of this we created for our site yesterday, by significant amounts, which reduces costs, reduces the cost of shipping by 20 to 25 days.
These right. Yeah, so it would be going into the southern coastal,
in Basra,
and then up through Iraq.
Yeah.
That's very interesting because, you know, we also, Iran has the Chabahar, starting in Chabahar and going up through the Caspian region towards Russia, and very similar things. So let's talk about that because you had very interesting reports about this idea that this is going to be, you know, transformative in ways that's, you know, historic, very significant strategically. So if you could give us a little bit more on that in terms of, you know, this area, West Asia, going back to what it was historically, this center of global trade, this center of global cooperation between East, West, North, and South. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
بعضیا میگن کلبتی درست نیست میگن زمان طاغوت مثل که وضع بعضیا از امروز
Some people might claim that religiosity was more widespread at the time of Pahlavi regime in Iran in comparison to Islamic Republic of Iran. How is it? طاغوت at the time of Pahlavi was a disbelieving dynasty. They had superficial beliefs. However, there were few people at that time that wished in heart and soul to be nurtured divinely. In better words, their wish of heart to be nurtured according to Islam saved them.
مثل آسیه همسر فرعون این که آسیه مؤمن شده
The good example in this regard is Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, who was guided to the right path because of the wish that she had in her heart. On the other hand, we have the wives of Noah and Lut as the prophets of Allah who betrayed the prophets of Allah and entered the fire. So, it is possible that the wife of Pharaoh, namely Asiya, enters paradise, and the wives of the prophets Noah and Lut enter hell. This does not mean that the rulership of Pharaoh was better than that of prophets Noah and Lut. This means that divine nurturing can even take place even in the palace of an oppressor, depending on the nature of the believers. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.